This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Right after the Big Bang, giant showers of neutrinos were spewed out all across the universe. And today, laboratories around the world are trying to detect these ghostly particles as they fly through the Earth. Those phantoms of physics could unlock mysteries about dark matter, about how the universe was formed. But did you know that deep space is not the only source for neutrinos? Every second, there are 10 to the 45, that's 10, that's 45 zeros. They're called geoneutrinos, and they're shooting out from inside the Earth. Neutrinos are also inside of nuclear power plants, all kinds of places on Earth, and now a map of our globe shows surprising places. They're called hotspots, where concentrated streams of neutrinos appear. And those results were published in a paper in the Journal of Scientific Reports. What can a neutrino map tell us? What can the hotspots tell us? Here to tell us is Stephen Dye. He's one of the authors on that paper. He's a professor of physics at the University of Hawaii and Hawaii Pacific University in Honolulu. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you very much, and that's a very good introduction.
Well, was I right on most of that stuff?
Very, very close, yes.
You made a map. Of two types of neutrinos. Where do the neutrinos come from? How are they measured?
Ah, very good. Well, we made a map, and of course, this is a co-authored work with a lot of fun people to work with. So we made the map in part by knowledge of where and how powerful nuclear reactors are on the surface of the Earth, and then based on geological models of the concentrations of heavy elements in the crust, and then the data that we've really used are measurements, as you suggest, in Japan and Italy that measure geoneutrinos. And taking the crust predictions and subtracting those off from the total that these observatories have seen, we're able to estimate how much are coming from the mantle. And this is the real golden fleece of geology, and because it points to how much power the Earth is generating inside, keeping itself warm and governing the cooling rate of the planet.
Why would there be hot spots? Why would some place have more neutrinos than others?
Ah, yes. So if listeners are able to pull up the website, you've put together a very nice preview with a map. And if they want to look at the map, but we can describe it nonetheless. The hot spots are close to the nuclear reactors. So think about a light bulb. And if you're close to the light bulb appears quite bright to you. As you get farther and farther away from the light bulb, of course, it gets dimmer and dimmer. The same effect applies here with the nuclear reactors. So if you're close to those, you will see, if you could see the neutrinos, a very bright spot. So the darkest spots on the map are in France and the eastern seaboard of the United States, and perhaps Japan, depending upon when you take the data for the map. There's also a very large blemish that's due to the geoneutrinos. And this is in Tibet, in the where the India plate is colliding with the Asian plate. And we have double the layer of continental crust there. And so that appears to be a bright blob, shall we say, on the surface of the Earth.
Could you tell from a map of neutrinos coming out of the Earth if there were any unknown nuclear reactors working that we don't know about, or someone trying to violate a nuclear reactor treaty? Wink, wink. You know?
Right. Well, that's obviously where this science can contribute, and we're very excited about that possibility. Knowing where all the reactors are that are registered anyway with the IAEA and what their power cycles are and so forth is incredibly valuable information for uncovering the potential clandestine reactor operating, outside the norm and perhaps burning fuel that could be used in a nuclear bomb is the threat there. And we have published papers, and others have published papers, on how to find these clandestine reactors. And it typically takes more than one detector is better, but a very, very large detector could potentially do the trick as well. Then you're going to have to get kind of close to where that you think that clandestine reactor might be.
When you say close, does that mean on the ground or flying over it?
Oh, yes. Well, there are backgrounds, of course, of these measurements of neutrinos, and some of those come from our atmosphere as cosmic rays bombard the upper atmosphere and create showers of particles coming down. these particles get in the way of our ability to detect the neutrinos from the Earth. Mm-hmm. And so it's good to get underground, or better yet, a project that we've been pushing is to go underwater. And this could tie in well with your guest coming up later in the show, going into the deep ocean, exploring the deep ocean.
You talked about the huge hotspot under the Himalayas, but if you look at the map of the neutrino hotspots in the Andes Mountains, there isn't. There isn't a hotspot there. What's happening?
Oh, very good. Very observant, of course. Yes,
I'm a good student today. I'm doing my homework.
Absolutely. And we're more attuned to what's going on in the Andes because of the large earthquake in Chile just the other day. And so there's tectonic activity in the Andes region as well. And although those mountains are quite high and the crust appears thick, those mountains are high because it's an oceanic plate that's pushing under the Andes Mountain, as opposed to a continental plate pushing under another continental plate in the Tibet Himalaya regions.
Hmm. So when they scrunch together, like, you know, in Tibet, you get a scrunching of the rock, you get more neutrinos, and as where they subduct underneath, as in the Andes, you're not getting as much.
Yeah, it's not the scrunching that causes the neutrinos. The neutrinos are coming from the decay of heavy elements, uranium and thorium and potassium.
Hmm.
In these maps, and those are just more concentrated in continental crust than in oceanic crust or in the mantle. So when you look at the map, it looks like you see blue oceans and red continents and so forth. Out in the ocean, we have thin oceanic crust, which doesn't have much of this uranium and thorium in the mantle underneath, whereas the continents look bright because they're enriched in the elements that produce the neutrinos.
Now, speaking of
to the model.
Speaking of being a good student, let's give me a physics 101 answer to the difference between a neutrino that comes from space and one of these geo neutrinos that come from the Earth. How do you tell the difference?
Yes. Well, ideally, you'd like to have a directional detector, a detector that tells you the direction of the neutrinos, and that can tell you a lot where its source is, because neutrinos don't curve their trajectories in space like a electrically charged particle would. But we don't have that for the geoneutrinos yet. We're working on that. And so what you can do is tell by their energy spectrum, because the beta decays, the radioactive decays producing the geoneutrinos and the reactor antineutrinos, have a characteristic energy spectrum. And your backgrounds will also populate certain regions of your energy spectrum. And by estimating all the backgrounds carefully and doing your subtractions, you come up with an estimate of the neutrinos from a given source. Now, right. The sun actually is a copious source of neutrinos and probably swamps the geoneutrino flux on the surface of the Earth by a factor of 100.
Yeah.
But those are neutrinos rather than antineutrinos and will interact by a different process. So by selecting our interaction process and then carefully analyzing the energy spectrum, observatories are able to, with wonderful precision, tell us how much the geoneutrinos are.
And why are you so interested in that? I know, astrophysicists are interested in measuring neutrinos to figure out the dark matter. Why are you so interested in the neutrinos that come out of the Earth?
Because it provides us a window inside the Earth, which we can't access that information by other means directly. And one of the main questions in geology is how much energy is being produced inside the Earth. This tells us things like, when did the inner core form and what's its rate of formation and the thermal evolution of the planet? How fast is it cooling down? What complement of primordial heat is left inside the planet? And this tells us stuff about how the planet formed, what materials it formed from, and how it got to its present state from its initial state.
Mm-hmm. You must have a next step you'd like to take in your math.
Thank you for opening that door.
I usually give the blank check question, but I'll give it to you.
Yeah. Well, our dream is to build an observatory that could go down into the deep ocean and measure the geoneutrinos coming most directly out of the mantle, because we're far from the bright spots in the continents and the nuclear reactors that are operating on the continents. And this will get us the most precise measurement of the geoneutrinos coming out of the mantle, which is a huge volume in the Earth and reservoir of this uranium and thorium. And so that will give us the best direct measurement of the heat being generated inside the planet and unlock some of the answers to these questions we raised earlier.
Would Hawaii be a good spot to have the laboratory?
Yes, yes, it would. and so we actually have attempted to propose a project out near Hawaii for this, and we're trying to build the demonstrator unit that can show interviewers of the proposal that we can operate the technology in the deep ocean.
Mm-hmm. And anything, do you have any data left over from your map that you haven't put out yet? Another good map or something?
Well, yeah, we plan on publishing revisions to the AGM, that's not annual general meeting, but anti-neutrino global map, when it becomes appropriate. And there's already been one update on the observatory observational data from Italy. So that could be incorporated. And we're working to refine the model of the crust and the flux of geoneutrinos coming out of the crust. That's all modeled in this map that you see there. And that also ties in with the mantle measurement.
Yeah.
So yes, there will be further editions of the map, and those will come about by greater exposure from detectors to geoneutrinos and as we refine our models.
Mm-hmm. Well, if anybody's interested in seeing the map, we have it up there on our website at sciencefriday.com, and look forward to the modifications as you make them, Stephen. Thank you for taking time to be with us today, and good luck.
You're very welcome, Ira, and thank you for all you do to make science more accessible to everyone.
You're welcome. Stephen Dye is professor of physics at the University of Hawaii and Hawaii Pacific University in Honolulu. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we're going to talk to science journalist John Palfreyman about his journey with Parkinson's disease and the advancements in treatments for that disease. And we'll talk about his new book after this break. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. 60,000 people each year in the United States alone are diagnosed with Parkinson's disease. Michael J. Fox, Muhammad Ali are the two most public faces of the disease. You might recognize the tremors that characterize the disease. But there are smaller changes that aren't as easily seen, like a loss of smell, fainting spells, all signs of the neurological battle happening within the brain. In 1985, my next guest investigated the group of drug addicts that developed symptoms of Parkinson's after taking a bad dose of heroin. His documentary, The Case of the Frozen Addicts, was a case study in treatments for Parkinson's at that time. And now nearly 30 years later, after that documentary aired, he himself was diagnosed with Parkinson's disease. He now says it has become, quote, his journalistic beat to understand Parkinson's disease and find a cure. He describes that journey in his new book, Brainstorms. John Palfreyman is a science journalist, author of the new book, Brainstorms. John and I have known each other for years, and he joins us from WGBH in Boston. Welcome to Science Friday, John.
Hello, Ira. Good to be here.
How are you feeling?
Pretty good so far. It's holding steady. I've had it about 4 years, but as you say, it was pretty ironic that of all the diseases that I get, it would be Parkinson's, a story that I'd worked on 25 years before. Mm.
Tell us how you discovered you had the disease.
Well, I developed a tremor in my left hand, and I didn't take it seriously. I thought my mother had a condition called essential tremor, which is benign, and I was convinced it was that. But I went to see a neurologist, and he diagnosed it as Parkinson's disease. And I didn't react in a very sort of sophisticated way. I think initially I denied it and sought second opinions. I got pretty angry. Mm-hmm. I tried to keep it secret for a while, just like Michael J. Fox did. And it took me, I'd say, about a year before I really processed it properly. And then I realized that I had a destiny to use my training as a science journalist and my insights as a patient to explore this malady, which was now going to be part of my life.
Mm-hmm. In your book, you describe having Parkinson's as a bit like going on vacation and driving on the wrong side of the road. How has it affected your daily routine?
Well, there's a part of the brain called the basal ganglia that does an awful lot of things automatically, so you don't have to think about it. And so I think it is very much like getting on a plane and going to London and renting a car. You can drive on the left-hand side of the road, but you have to use your conscious brain to pay attention. Everything's a bit harder. Mm. When I walk, I have to sort of consciously move my arms back and forth, whereas when a healthy person does it, it's automatic. And so a lot of things that you got for free, you have to work at.
Mm-hmm. Talking with John Palfreyman, author of Brainstorms, The Race to Unlock the Mysteries of Parkinson's Disease. If you'd like to talk about that disease, have some anecdote you'd like to share or a question, our number, 844-724-8255. And as always, you can tweet us at SciFry. John, in your documentary, The Case of the Frozen Addict, you profiled a neurologist, Bill Langston, that looked at a compound called MPTP. What did that discovery tell us about Parkinson's?
Well, that was a spontaneously discovered neurotoxin. The backstreet chemist who'd been trying to make a synthetic drug had botched his synthesis and created this toxin, which turned out to be incredibly useful for modeling the disease in animals. So you could cause it now in primates and test new drugs. And this looked like a very promising avenue. And as a result of it, a whole series of strategies were tried to protect neurons, dopamine neurons mainly, to try and revive sick neurons and in most controversially to replace using neural grafts with fetal tissue dead neurons for new ones. But none of those strategies have really turned out to work very well.
Mm. Do you view that time differently now as a patient?
I see it differently as a patient, yes. I mean, there's no doubt that the journalist sees the story as, yeah. In terms of discovery, but the patient sees things in terms of survival.
I thought it was very interesting in your book that Parkinson's was initially described as a movement disorder, but you write about the need to rebrand how we think about Parkinson's.
I think that's right. I think what we classically think of Parkinson's, the tremor, the slowness, the rigidity, the stooped gait, is really the middle act of a three-act play, and that basically the disease is present maybe 10 or 15 years before a person gets diagnosed and producing, as you mentioned in your introduction, subtle things like loss of smell, constipation, maybe sleep disorders, and then the pathology moves on to the midbrain to create the movement part, and then after the person gets diagnosed, the disease continues in a third act and goes to affect other areas of the brain like the cortex, which can produce cognitive impairment and hallucinations and things like that. So it's a much more systemic disease than it was once thought to be. But out of that concept has come a target, because the idea is that the thing that's causing all the damage is now hypothesized to be a protein called alpha-synuclein, which goes rogue and which forms sticky clumps called amyloids, and they jump from cell to cell, killing cells in their wake. So there's a strategy at least now where we can attack this.
Are there tests going on to try to do that?
Yes, there's a whole series of compounds which if alpha-synuclein is causing all the problems, then trying to reduce the levels of it makes perfect sense. And in the next year or two, going into clinical trials, there are a number of products which are designed to sort of dissolve alpha-synuclein. And if they work, I mean, the prospects are amazing, that somebody who didn't have the disease, if you could get in early enough, would never develop the motor symptoms. And somebody like me who had the motor symptoms could possibly be stabilized so it didn't get any worse. So there's a lot of excitement at the moment around this.
And you write in your book that alpha-synuclein research gives you genuine hope.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I think you've got, as a journalist, you've got to see that biomedical research moves very slowly. There's lots of things which give hope, which don't pan out. But this seems like a very good idea. And it's been, for a couple of decades, people have been working on it, trying to get things. There's a company in Cambridge, Massachusetts, which is producing a product called Neurophage, and this product may potentially not just dissolve alpha-synuclein, but also the equivalent amyloids in other diseases like Alzheimer's and mm-hmm. Huntington's. So there's a lot of potential there.
Did you go through what a lot of people go through when they're diagnosed with a disease? I'm going to try all the wacky ideas too, the things that you know, that are on the fringe of medicine.
No, I didn't. I think a lifetime of science, being a science journalist, immunizes you against some of those things.
No.
No, I didn't. So I didn't. And I'm sure you wouldn't have either if you had the same situation.
Mm-hmm. L-DOPA is the gold standard for Parkinson's treatment. But you're right that L-DOPA therapy seems like a Faustian bargain. What are the problems with L-DOPA that you have to make that deal?
Well, I think what's wonderful about L-DOPA, when people first started using L-DOPA, you can see old films from the 60s of it. It's literally life restorative. They took people who couldn't move and let them move. But what happens is after a certain amount of time, it might be 4 years, 5 years, 6 years, 7 years, 8 years, you get what are called motor complications. You can get involuntary movements, which are called dyskinesias. Everybody's seen Michael J. Fox. He can talk, but he can't control his movements all the time. And other things that happen is that the medication can switch off suddenly and fluctuate. And so it's a Faustian bargain, but it's not one you can really afford to turn down because there's nothing really like levodopa. Before levodopa came along, patients with Parkinson's lived an average of 6 or 7 years, and now they survive 20, 25, 30 years. So it's night and day.
Oliver Sacks, of course, made it famous in the movie that was made about him and in his writings before then. When you were diagnosed and you knew Oliver's history of research with it, did you have any feelings about contacting him?
Yes, I've known Oliver for a long time, and he's a remarkable man.
I figured you would, yeah.
And his group of patients who had a type of encephalitis lethargicus, it's a special type of Parkinsonism. They got better with that L-DOPA, but then immediately afterwards they got these terrible side effects, which can include hallucinations and horrible things like that. But basically, for most patients, it's a positive good.
And why does it stop working?
Well, it doesn't really stop working. What you've got to remember is that the disease is progressing, so there are fewer and fewer dopamine neurons for it to work on. Mm. And after a time, the L-DOPA sort of slips into the brain because it can pass through the blood-brain barrier. And then it needs to find a cell which can turn it into dopamine, which is the chemical you need. And I think some of the work is being done by other neurons, like serotonin neurons. They're doing the work, but they're not designed to do it, so they just splurt it out. And so I think you're not getting the same experience of a genuine live neuron with dopamine neuron. You're getting something that's pretty good but not perfect. And that's where the complications come in, I think.
Mm-hmm. Let me see if I can get a quick call in before a break. Let's go to Birmingham, Alabama. Pam, welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, thank you. My question has to do with crack cocaine. And a friend of mine had Parkinson's. He'd had it for maybe 10 years. It was a slow progressing. And he got into crack cocaine, and because it gives you a flush of dopamine, I'm just wondering if that could have had anything to do with the addiction.
I don't know about that, but there's a class of drugs called dopamine agonists, which have led to compulsive behavior. And basically, you may know this, Ira, of this story, that between 10 and 15% of people who take dopamine agonists develop pathologies of gambling and sex addiction, which is quite remarkable. Dopamine is a reward center of the brain, so it's a very kind of critical system in the brain, and strange things happen. But these people who have the compulsions, if they stop the drug, the compulsions go away.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to Maggie in Beaufort, South Carolina. Hi, Maggie.
Hi, thank you so much for having me. It's actually Beaufort, but we're way deep in the South, so don't worry about the pronunciation.
My apologies.
No worries. So I quit smoking about 2 years ago and was promptly diagnosed 2 weeks actually after, with severe essential tremors. And I'm a writer and a professor, so that's kind of a problem. So not being able to write becomes difficult. So in any case, I went through the course of, you know, the various things they try to give you for it, none of which, of course, are designed for essential tremors. And they make very clear the differentiation between Parkinson's and ET. Except for that, those boundaries seem to be really, really blurry. And I was unable to take any of the pharmaceuticals I mean, I'm the 1% as far as side effects go for everything. So you were discussing that, and I just, first of all, wanted sympathy in that. But second, any thoughts you have? I mean, here's I'm asking essentially for resources. I'm on a whole bunch of message boards for ET, and there's a lot of people who just offer great advice. We're all just, you know, muddling through it as best we can. And then there's no certainty in anything. But I guess I have a question and just an observation, and that is that a lot of the information comes just from the front lines, right? What does work, what doesn't work, and that we're all muddling through. But anything you want to add about the uncertainty, I guess.
Let me remind everybody that this is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. That's to help pay the bills. John Palfreyman, author of Brainstorms. John, what is a good general source for people who have questions about Parkinson's or tremors?
Well, essential tremor is a different thing. It's not neurodegenerative, so your essential tremor shouldn't get any worse, which is very good news. But as for strategies, they're not, to my knowledge, any specific drugs. I mean, some of the surgical interventions like deep brain stimulation might work pretty well for essential tremor if you were ready to go that route. Mm-hmm. How disabling is your essential tremor? Can you not type with it?
She's dropped off the phone, so she'll hear what you have to say. But do you hear this a lot now that you've written the book, people asking for all kinds of advice?
Yes, you do. I mean, which I think indicates that people are kind of lost. And whether it's cancer or whether it's Parkinson's or whether it's Alzheimer's, when you get a diagnosis, your life changes and you seek out people. And one of the great things about the Parkinson's community is that it's full of people with great advice. There's a ballet dancer, Pamela Quinn, who lives in New York, who teaches Parkinson patients how to trick their bodies, how to move using her bodily wisdom. And there's all kinds of folk knowledge which help you on a day-to-day basis.
Can you retrain your different parts of your body?
Yes, you can. I mean, exercise, the one thing which really everybody should do is regular exercise, because people who do exercise and stay mobile, they do much, much, much better than people who withdraw and give up. You've still got the conscious part of your brain. You can still drive like you're driving in London on the wrong side of the road. It just takes a bit more energy and effort, but it still works.
Mm-hmm. You talked about the research you're waiting to hear about. Are there more pressing questions for scientists working on a cure for Parkinson's that you've discovered?
Well, I think there's, you can divide cures into sort of disease modifying, which is what I was talking about before, things that actually interfere with the progress of the disease, and things which deal with treating the symptoms. And even though levodopa was discovered 50 years ago, there haven't been, in my view, very good research to find better ways to deliver it. If it was possible to deliver it more continuously, you'd get a better result. I think also that deep brain stimulation, which has been a bit of a hit or miss thing up until now, is poised to become much more sophisticated. I think in the future, just like we have very sophisticated heart pacemakers, we might get a situation where I've got an electrode in my brain, and just before my left hand wants to set off a tremor, it sets off a pulse and reboots that part of the brain and cures it. So I think these things look pretty promising, so that even if you haven't got a total cure, the management of the thing will become much better, and we'll be able to live pretty much essentially normal lives.
Mm-hmm. And John Palfreyman, I want to thank you for writing the book and taking time to be with us today on Science Friday.
Nice to talk to you again, Ira.
You too. John Palfreyman, science journalist, author of the new book, Brainstorms. Excellent book if you were looking for some information on Parkinson's, and just a good read about John Palfreyman's experience. We're going to take a break. Actually, we have an excerpt for it on our website at sciencefriday.com/brainstorms. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we'll be talking about the deep sea exploration, so don't go away. We'll be right back. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. This week in the New York Times, journalist Chris Dixon posed the question, do humans have a future in deep sea exploration? With the prevalence of remotely operated vehicles, the ROVs, and the autonomous underwater vehicles, aka UVs, there's less financial support for manned submersibles. And just for context, NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, has a fraction of the exploration budget that NASA does. Dixon found that in fiscal year 2014, NOAA had $26 million for deep sea exploration, compared to NASA's $4 billion budget for space exploration, of course, outside of the planet. So with limited resources, what is the best way to investigate the largely unexplored watery depths of our planet's oceans? Joining me to talk about the future of deep sea exploration are Sylvia Earle, famed oceanographer, founder of Mission Blue, and a National Geographic Society explorer in residence. Sylvia, always great to have you back. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, great to be back, Ira.
You're welcome. Colin Wallerman is a pilot and technician at the Hawaii Undersea Research Laboratory, or HURL, H-U-R-L, in Oahu. Welcome to Science Friday, Colin.
It's a pleasure to be here, Ira.
And Hanamu Singh is a senior scientist at the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institute in Massachusetts. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you.
Let me begin with you, Sylvia. Can you imagine your work as an oceanographer without a trip to the ocean depths? I mean, what would your understanding of the ocean be like if we never went down there?
As I say, there's nothing like being there. I don't think this is an either-or debate or whatever. We need all the tools in the box. I wholeheartedly approve of AUVs and remotely operated vehicles. They can go places that you probably wouldn't want to go or send a human being, and they can stay for long periods of time under circumstances that wouldn't be so appropriate for humans sometimes. But they cannot do what a human can do, especially a trained human, but even one, you know, a human being who's curious. Machines are not curious. They have no sense of humor. They cannot follow hunches. Mm-hmm. And a scientist or a kid, anyone, has that capacity to wonder and to explore.
And if you see something that you didn't expect down there, you can just pilot your way over there.
That's correct. Yeah, that's right. Well, you can, in a sense, from the surface, piloting a remotely operated system, but it's just not the same. You have a limited view, and spatial correspondence is different, but it's a qualitatively different experience. Mm-hmm. And I talk with my friend and colleague Bob Ballard about this sometimes, because he is a very strong proponent of, you don't need people underwater. We've got other means. Right. And you say, sure. It's like, well, you can take a nice film, even a live video feed, back to having a fine dinner in a restaurant in Paris, drink the wine, just looking at it vicariously, or you can be there.
Drink the wine.
There's a qualitative difference.
Let me bring in someone who is a pilot of a remote vehicle. Colin Wallerman, you pilot the Pisces subs out there in Hawaii. What's it like to be in the deep sea? Help us understand what it feels like to be underwater like that.
Well, first off, I pilot Pisces subs, but I also have spent a fair amount of time piloting ROVs, so I'd like to think I bring a kind of comparative element to the conversation. And, you know, like Dr. Earle said, piloting the subs when you're actually on bottom, when your spatial awareness is on the edge of its seat, if you were. I mean, you have firsthand data just hitting all your senses at the same time. There's no real comparison. And don't get me wrong, I am equally as impressed with some of the technologies associated with ROVs and with AUVs. I mean, the work they do is phenomenal, but being in person, being in place, and they're different tools, like Dr. Earle said. You can't really compare the two for most applications.
Hanamut Singh, you do undersea robots. What can an undersea robot do that a manned person submersible?
Well, you know, I should back up and point out that I actually have worked on all sorts of vehicles. I worked on Alvin, which is probably the most famous of all the manned submersibles. I worked on ROVs, and I worked on AUVs. And I think, you know, Sylvia said it initially in our conversation, which is that there's no real competition, is the way I look at it. I think they're all complementary. I think each of those vehicles has a role. You know, I've dove in Ireland to the bottom of the seafloor. It was a fantastic experience, okay? Having said that, the data we get with our AUVs is also amazing in its own way. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and there's always a trade-off about what do you really want to do? You know, do you want to go out and experience the ocean, you know, really live as you are there? And there's, you know, there's merit in that. And then on the flip side is, do you want to collect long-term data? Do you want to do stuff that's too boring for human beings to do? Okay, a lot of times we're making maps of the seafloor. When we are searching for Malaysian Airlines Flight 370 because we don't know what the bottom looks like, we aren't even in view of the seafloor. So that's boring stuff where the best of pilots get bored and don't want to do that work. That's where these robots can actually come in and do a really good job. On the flip side, if you're a geologist and you want to go in there and pick up specific samples, then when you have a manned submersible, you know, for sampling in an environment like that, it's the best platform there is. So I think it's a false statement to say, you know, do we really want manned submersibles, or do we want AUVs, or do we only want ROVs? I think there's a role for all three of them in there, and they all have important roles.
Mm-hmm. So how do you decide? I mean, there's such a small pot of money compared to exploring other planets, for exploring our own planet, which we probably, as we've been saying for years, we know more about the far side of the moon than the bottom of the oceans. Sylvia, how do you decide? How do you divide it up? I mean, how do you get more money, I guess?
Well, you've hit on the real problem. It is not either or, manned or remote systems. It's what are we thinking to be neglecting the ocean? We've invested in aviation and aerospace, and it has paid off handsomely. We've neglected the ocean, and it's costing us dearly. Right now, the exploitation of the ocean has been progressing at a high speed throughout, especially the latter part of the 20th century, with the extraction of ocean wildlife through fishing, and now with deep sea mining looming on the horizon. It was an issue back in the early 80s, and then it kind of phased out as the cost, the reality of what it would take to extract from the deep sea. And now we know that there are costs that should be accounted for, like the sacrifice of systems that we've just barely begun to explore. And
yeah, I'd like to
and yet it's happening.
Yeah. So, sorry, I'd like to elaborate on that too. I think, you know, I think the pot isn't big enough. I think, but it's not big enough in very interesting ways. One way it's not big enough is that we don't have enough money for infrastructure. And that's, you know, that's a problem we have with oceanography. We don't have enough ships. We don't have enough manned submersibles. We don't have enough equipment at the poles. We don't have enough icebreakers. So we are infrastructure limited. Having said that, you know, here's the good news. The good news is the quality of oceanography in this country has gone up amazingly. Okay, from the 50s, right after the Second World War, when there were just a handful of oceanography places, Woods Hole was one, Scripps was another one, Hawaii was another one, Lamont was another one. Now, of course, there are oceanographers in universities all over the world, all over the U.S. And so that's a good thing. We have more oceanographers, but because there's more scientific researchers and the pots become smaller, and there's not enough infrastructure, we're feeling it a lot more. Mm-hmm. You know, if you look at the budgets, of and the National Science Foundation, just like NIH, just like EPA, just like the Office of Naval Research, just like NOAA, the major proponents of oceanography, their budgets have been flat for the last 10 years. The only budget, only federal agency whose budget has not been flat has been NASA. And we can see the difference.
What about, Colin, I know you've done some work with the oil and gas sector with ROVs. Do you see a difference in the amount of money they can spend? I mean, they're not part of the government, and the quality of stuff that they can do?
Yeah, you do see that. There's definitely a difference, you know, between what the oil gas sector budgets have. And of course, they're for profit, so they're out using money to make money. So it's a whole different platform. I would like to speak to the infrastructure of the science work, though. I mean, we have, it's an interesting phenomenon we have going on at Hawaii Undersea Research Lab. We have scientists coming to us saying that they want to use us, that that we're the best tool for their job, but are being told by the agencies that fund their work that they must use some of these other assets instead of the Hawaii Undersea Research Lab. Now, it's beyond kind of the scope of my expertise to, you know, talk about who or why, but the reality is this is a problem, and not just for HURL, but for the science community as a whole. Our science community have a tall order and a tough budget environment, and their work is critical to understanding the processes of the deep ocean and the world, really. So why would we deny them the tools they need? They ask for us by name because they know that we are the best tool for their specific needs in a lot of cases. So this is an important conversation to have, and I'd like to see some results.
What is the politics going on here? What is the politics behind this?
I think the issue is
You know, it does come down to who wants to use what. I think if you look at the way oceanography is organized, you know, we have some mechanisms set up which deal with this. So here's a classic example. I'm a researcher at Woods Hole, which is in, you know, south of Boston, on the east coast of the U.S. I want to work in say Alaska. It doesn't make sense for me to use a Woods Hole ship to go all the way to Alaska and work there. So what we do as a community is we say, okay, Hanu wants to write, Hanu and his PIs want to write a proposal to go to Alaska. What are the facilities in Alaska that we can use? And it turns out the Alaskans have a ship. It's called the Sikulyak. And they say, okay, here's the Sikulyak. Hanu, why don't you and your party move there and use that ship? So they have a way of spreading it around so that we, you know, optimizing the resources that we have. And I think that system works pretty well. However, what is a problem is, of course, that, you know, we don't have enough resources overall, and that's definitely true. So there is a nice way of sharing out the resources. You know, it's not that all the resources should go to one institution or to one person or to one set of organizations. I believe there's 16 oceanographic vessels which are run by different universities all over the U.S., and we all share them and use them as makes sense.
Mm-hmm. I need to remind
everybody first that this is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Who's jumping in there?
That was
Sylvia.
Sylvia.
Sylvia, go right ahead. The sea floor is all yours.
It's the loss of the capacity to actually take humans underwater that is now being shortchanged, at least in this country. But you see China going full speed ahead. They have a 7,000-meter sub that is in active use right now, the Sea Dragon, and they're building a full ocean depth research submarine. Japan, similarly, is looking at full ocean depth. They're building not just for remote-operated systems, but manned systems. Russia, likewise, has not just the two Mir subs that have been in active use since 1987, but they're also investing in manned systems. Popular view of Putin in a little sub operating in the Black Sea just a couple of weeks ago that made the rounds around the world. What are we thinking in this country that we're just investing, whatever it is that we've got, in a partial toolbox? The whole Aquarius underwater laboratory was defunded as far as taxpayer support is concerned, and now private money is helping to fill the gap, and it's private money that is helping to come in and stave off the decline or demise of all but support that is given for ALVIN.
Come in here too, because, you know, some of what you just said, Sylvia, I don't quite agree with. I think if you look at where we are in the U.S., we operate the preeminent submarine in the world. It's called manned submarine. It's called ALVIN, and there is no two ways about it. Every other nation in the world looks at our program as a model program. And then if we look at the other robotics programs, whether it's for ROVs, for scientific ROVs, again, we are operating the best programs, not just one institution, but, you know, you look at Mbari, you look at Hui, I know Hawaii is getting one, Scripps is getting one, so we're leading that. And then we look at AUVs as well, and, you know, autonomous underwater aircraft. Again, we are way ahead of everybody else. Having said that, I worry about what the future brings. I think, you know, oceanography as a whole has some interesting issues in terms of sustainability and how we can keep that going forward. But right now, you know, we are actually doing some amazing work, whether we're looking at climate change with underwater robots, looking at sea ice, whether we're looking at fisheries, whether we're looking at deep sea archaeology, whether we're looking at geology and geophysics. But we're doing some amazing work.
Yeah, you are doing amazing work, but compared to the other research funding that goes on, you're a rounding figure, you know? The amount of money that's being invested is lost in the decimal point.
I agree with you. I agree with you, Ira. I mean, here's another, you know, when I give a talk, here's one thing I often point out, you know. I often ask my audience to, you know, try and figure out how much they thought, you know, the total budget of ocean sciences is versus the cost of a single launch of the space shuttle, okay? And it turns out, you know, we're comparable. So a single launch, and we had hundreds of those launches, was comparable. And then the next question I ask them is, can you tell me, you know, one good piece of science that the space shuttle did? And most people will say, oh, it was amazing. I remember. And they can't come up with a real, you know, and whereas if you ask them, what did, you know, oceanography do for you, they can list out 10 different things of high social relevance. They can talk about fisheries, they can talk about climate, they can talk about all these other things. And so this disconnect, you know, we need to grapple with it. And we need to grapple with it at the politician level so that, you know, we can restore some of the disparities that exist in funding.
This is a great year to do that. This is a great political season to bring it up, not just on a presidential level, but all the local levels where money is, Congress hides all the money. I'd like to thank Sylvia Earle, oceanographer, founder of Mission Blue, National Geographic Society explorer in residence. Colin Wallerman, pilot and technician at the Hawaii Undersea Research Laboratory, Hurl in Oahu. And Hanumat Singh, he's a senior scientist at Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution in Massachusetts. Thank you all for taking time to be with us today and discussing this. You're welcome. B.J. Lederman composed our theme music. Our thanks to our production partners at the studios of the City University of New York. Of course, we're podcasting all week. If you want to hear this again or you've missed some parts of Science Friday, get our podcast. Go to our website at sciencefriday.com. Join our mailing list, all kinds of resources for you. We'll see you on Twitter and on our website all week. Have a great weekend. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.